analyst told me that I was right out of my head, the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not, don't know. My analyst told me that I was right out of my head. He said I'd need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined when out of his sight to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts, no more ifs, or ands, or buts. They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening, I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be. Now I heard little children were supposed to sleep tight. That's why I got into the vodka one night. My parents got frantic, didn't know what to do. But I saw some crazy scenes before I came to now. Do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They all laughed at angry young men. They all laughed at Edison and also at Einstein. So why should I feel sorry if they just couldn't understand the idiomatic logic that went on in my head? I had a brain, it was insane. Oh, they used to laugh at me when I refused to ride on all those double-decker buses, all because there was no driver on the top.
What, no driver on the top?
Man, the chick is twisted. Crazy, oop, shooby, here, flip city.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, but I said, dear doctor, I think that it's you instead, because I have got a thing that's unique and new. To prove it, I'll have the last laugh on you, because instead of one head, I got two. And you know two heads are better than one.
Hello. It's good to talk to you. I hope everybody had some restorative quality to the break. I'm sure that there was a variety of activity levels connected with school, from too much to just fine without, and I hope that where you struck the balance leaves you feeling now ready to contemplate the meaning of the time remaining before you're done. The stretch from what is usually actually spring vacation to the end of the term is a tricky part of law school, and it is good to have a moment or two to contemplate both what it is and what it isn't, and how you will and how you won't allow yourself to be altered by it. But it might be helpful to come to that question as an application of ideas that, well, I hope you had a chance to think about a little bit during the break. I have been reading work of yours, and I like, before I start to look at particular pieces closely, to have a broad sense of what everything is like. So I read it all before I start working on any of it, and I'm interested and, well, I can feel the difference between writing from inside a confined life, because I've never read the writing of people who all had to live a confined life all at once like this before. By the time last spring that people had to go into the process of remote instruction and I had to activate the system I had been building for 7 years, waiting for such a moment to happen, people had already done writing, and the writing that I worked on was writing that had sort of been pithed of purpose as people's semester dissolved and the grading system went away and everybody reoriented themselves around all the things that you're now trying to climb out of. But it's interesting writing, and I look forward to writing about and discussing it with you. And in trade, I tried to give you something that was precious to me, made of pieces of writing that I'm sure you didn't quite admire as much as you would like to admire your own. And you're right, Putnam is not the writer that you want to become. But then there's a thing I didn't tell you about the way we are, which you could find out by reading the epilogue, which I hope you might be inclined to do. Robert Putnam was dying when he wrote this book. It represents the sum of the learning of a man's lifetime as he tries to communicate what it is that he knows about something really important, namely the way we are, when his life among us is about to end. And I think that judged by the nature of the task for which Mr. Putnam is living and working under the circumstances that confront him, it is as much a human masterpiece as it is intellectually a crucial guide to something which is at the pivot of the machine we are making, where all the force of mechanical understanding from every other discipline also must come to meet the two greatest ideas that the 19th century bequeathed to us. It is important to begin by recognizing, which I hope you did in the course of being a little frustrated by the nature of the detail, whether about the baby watchers or the forms of experimentation at the National Institutes of Mental Health concerning state switches in bipolar patients, you recognize that in the grand literary scale of 19th century thinking, when people wrote not just long books, but many long books in order to reach readers whose capability of reading, well, was very great, let us say, that Charles Darwin wrote on orchids and two volumes on coral reefs and one on earthworms and the making of soil and one on the origin of species and one on the descent of man and one on the expression of emotions in man and animals, and all of them consiliently contributed to an understanding which Darwin called this view of life, and which is an idea of such overwhelming importance because it is a view of life, and outward from it comes what we understand about how to organize our knowledge of the history of life and the biology which we use to study existing life before our eyes, and a host of disciplines in linguistics and historical sciences which take their method of understanding and explanation from the view of life that is the idea that we call Darwin. And of course, it's also true of the psychologies that bind up together to produce synthetically this view of the way we are, which is an evolutionary view, as you understand, both with respect to its effort to conduct the process of joining brain and mind, to overcome Cartesian dualism and to use all of the brain science of now to understand, well, the idea we call Freud, which isn't Freudianism, though it's crucially important that this weaving of psychologies that gives us an opportunity to add to our social theory of how things happen, psychological understanding of the way we are. Because, of course, that is the context into which all this consilient explanation will be put in our world into consilient explanations of things which are both what Putnam cares about, which is an extraordinary breadth of understanding of the way we are, from individual mental illness to the problems of addiction and abuse, which not only are problems of social psychology, but which are lawyers' problems, no matter how you think of it. But to begin with, this is part of the evolutionary psychology which begins with William James and ends in all the future contests between all the schools that will exist, not only how are we? But how did we become this way? And how, within the lifetime of the organism and the community, do we change? Which is as fundamental a concern for us as lawyers as it is for clinical psychotherapists. In the nature of a lawyer's theory of how to make things happen in society using words, we are constructing a theory of social action, how things happen. And there is no way for us to have an effective theory of how things happen in society without coming to the conclusion succinctly expressed by that American military man, part of the permanent government of the United States for so long, Colin Powell, who said, everything is made of people. Which, from the point of view of a man with the intellectual and social ambition of Colin Powell, is an artist's rendering of the meaning of what is in the tube or the bronze or the dance. Everything is made of people. So our theory of social action, how to make things happen in society, is, among other things, a theory of how people are. In some disciplines of legal activity, the relationship between the lawyering and the theory of how people are needs to be explicit. This is generally true of lawyering on behalf of children's welfare in the United States, which is seen as a discipline one of whose immediate ancillaries is the developmental psychology and the educational psychology and all the other ways in which thinking about how we are when we are children affects what we try to do, making things happen in society using words. And equally, it is true in the places where a theory of how we are is not seen as immediately an ancillary discipline. Though you cannot practice criminal justice law either as a prosecutor or as defense counsel without requiring some deep theoretical understanding of how things go wrong. A theory which might be, as Robinson's theory is, eclectic, made of what he sees around him. But not surprisingly, as you will recall of Robinson, one of those details at the edges of his poetic being, that he made his life partnership with a woman who is a child welfare worker and part of the government of society on behalf of children. It's not surprising, really, in a way. His theory's eclectic, but his acquaintance with the way we think about how people are when they are young and go wrong is really important nonetheless. And for all his hard-boiled understanding of the Serbian Fujianese kid, he has other understandings which are beneath and below, including, of course, as always, in his personal set of state cyclings, the boy man who was sent to kill and die in Vietnam. We are always looking at people. Sometimes, of course, we have decided to practice law on the 54th floor of a building somewhere on 6th Avenue that has sealed windows and in which only filtered sunlight and filtered air are ever admitted. And if that's where we choose to practice, then the people we will be looking at will look something or other like us. They will be similarly dressed and perfumed, and they will be sitting down in similar chairs to our own, and they will fumble with the same basic objects. And some of us will practice in ways that have nothing whatever to do with looking at people who are that much like us. But whichever way it works, we will always be looking at people. And the people that we are looking at will be the way we are. And everything we wish to do will address words at people, some of whom we know well, and some of whom we must get fast acquainted with, because we are working rapidly at first impression with them, but we have some purpose or other which is built into our words and which is not only peripherally about them, because they are part of our network, because they make decisions, because they control resources, because they can provide help or cause interference, or because they help us to deliver what we get for our clients, or because they help us to find clients and believe in the viability of our practice. But whatever is the reason, and as lawyers we have always purpose, that's our distinguishing characteristic, is purpose in using words, we're always looking at people. Because everything is made of people. And one of the fundamental platforms on which we must build whatever it is that we are building in our world to make ourselves rich or to change society for the better or some combination of the two, whatever it is that we are doing, it's made of people, and we need to know the way they are. How are we? If you have just spent time reading 40,000 words made by us, then I will say, not surprising you, I'm sure, that we are conflicted. Some might say ambivalent, but because ambivalent implies a bothness, it might be a little thin on the ground. There's more than two in most of these conflicts. The idea we call Freud began the 20th century by pointing out that the majority of our mental activity is unconscious. As you see, just because we call that idea Freud doesn't mean there isn't a lot of William James in it. And because there is a lot of William James in it, there is a lot of America in it, and there's also a lot of Charles Darwin in it. And Sigmund Freud in America is a real subject on which, indeed, his biographer Jones spent a volume. Though he never lived here. But we are concerned because our ultimate concern is how to use our understanding of the way we are to make things happen in society using words where everything is made of people. We are concerned not merely to understand how individual psychic life is organized. We are always concerned with how individual psychic lives, organized as they are, interact with one another. We are by nature driven to use our intrapsychic psychology in order to found social psychology, in order to understand not only the way we are as human beings individually, healthy or unwell, but in order to understand how we interact better, in order to understand the influence of minds on minds more thoroughly, in order then to begin our assigned task, which is to figure out how to implement purposes using words. These forms of understanding, then, require us to take the information and the insight and the instincts that we can draw from the psychology of individuals and what we can glean from the writings of the disciplines that are social psychology and are adjacent to disciplines of sociology and anthropology and, yes, even economics, even slightly, sometimes, maybe. And to use them in order to gain an understanding of sometimes a social locale, like the moment where the deal is made, and sometimes a social structure, like the understanding that the churches to which white people go and their role in politics is one thing, and the churches to which black people go and their role in politics is another thing, if you are legislators in the state of Georgia anyway, and how that conversation might be driven away from pointless and sterile language intended only to serve immediate partisan purpose, to convince both marginal voters and their moderate legislative representatives that possibly this is not the way to have the conversation, after all, and to change the way the conversation works, which is often what is required in order to make a thing happen using words. The lawyers with whom I work in my practice, the Software Freedom Law Center and all the various other little pieces that hang around it, the lawyers who work for me have heard that our brand is, when we show up, the situation changes. The point is, after all, that unlike some of the kinds of lawyering that can be done and that you might want to do, the kind of lawyering I want to do with the lawyers I am training is a kind of lawyering which often involves changing the subject. Actually, what it does is involve adding views to the subject which are effective in altering the dynamic of the social structure or activity because they have changed the way individuals within that system made of people have understood themselves, their roles, and the possibility of the system. In order to do which, we need to understand how people are and why they change. And that doesn't necessarily mean change on the scale in which the psychotherapist is interested, any more than it means change on the scale on which a poker player is interested. We're not about only individual decisions, although often we are about individual decisions. And maybe they are no more difficult than the decision faced by the poker player whether to see, raise, or fold, which we are trying to influence at the table. But they may seem more difficult, or at any rate, the stakes may be both less simple and less visible. It all depends on whether we're trying to affect the sentencing that will be handed out against our client, or what will happen to a claim brought by an incarcerated psychiatric patient concerning the statement of the guards that he broke his jaw in four places while slipping in the shower where they happened also to be with him. Which I can assure you society is likely to regard as a low-stakes decision. So, in the beginning, then, it's important to recognize that the isomorphism which is pursued in trying to understand at many different levels the role of ideas of state in the explanation of the structure of human psychic life necessitates consilient explanation. That is, the function of trying to understand isomorphically how a complex system is in different ways built of similar analogic parts pursuing similar analogic functions, even if they look quite different, including that some of them are physical objects that exist and some of them are not, is the form of explanation which characterizes the depth of that profound idea that we call Darwin, and which is also the idea that we call Marx, addressed to problems of evolutionary sociology in a historical vein of analysis which seeks for isomorphic relations based in structures of making a living, not in a view of life, but in a view of society's collective history. The great ideas of the 19th century were pursued in this way by the many human beings who collectively contributed in layers large and small to the ideas that we call Darwin, Marx, and Freud, and which have formed the basis of dialectic of belief and disbelief and support and absence of support and hostility and friendship, which have vivified the intellectual life of humankind throughout a horrible 20th century, which is now giving way to a different and potentially more horrible 21st. And we are wondering about Christine and what happened when, deprived of sleep, her mood switches so suddenly, and how dissociative disorders give rise to multiple identities, and how babies sleep, but really, how to understand the way we are, conflicted as we are, in law school, in law practice, in marriage, in parenting, and, well, pretty much everywhere at different levels of intensity, pretty much all the time. What Putnam offers is a man's understanding of his work over a lifetime and its relation to all the different knowledges in which, as a scientist, which is what he is, and a clinician, which is what he sometimes becomes, and a theorist, which he's reluctant to be recurrently throughout his life, but which at the point of death he has no choice but to embrace, as he must embrace death itself. And as a reader who aspires to write like people whose writing he admires, he is our guide to a view. Not a doctrine, not a dogma, not a set of rules, not a particular book of plays, certainly not a wizard with a finite collection of spells, and maybe not conforming to your idea of what it means to be a Darwin, a Marx, or a Freud, but deeply conforming to mine. What he is for us is the doorway to a series of ideas, some of which are his and some of which are ours, and which allow us to be, as lawyers, more effective, more wise, more tolerant possibly, but certainly more capable in making things happen in society using words. Because everything is made of people and we have some idea about the way we are. How are we? We are conflicted. What does that mean? It means that we are not unitary minds, solid like a potato through and through, either mostly conscious or mostly unconscious. We are, well, I suppose you could say that we are what Walter Whitman thought we were when he noticed of himself that he was vast and contained multitudes, and who understood himself as a young gay man in the city to contain conflicted multitudes. But just because the 19th century was aware of this doesn't mean that it is easy for us to be aware of. Perhaps at the beginning, your sense of why Putnam is wrong, which a law student is likely to have because people's complex ideas are either right or wrong at the end of the day, perhaps your understanding of why Putnam was wrong is that, well, you don't consider yourself to be possessed of multiple personalities, which, of course, he agrees with. We all think we're us. By which we really mean we think we're me, except we can't say that because we don't have a grammar for saying that. And in fact, our grammar, though it contains first-person pronouns, recognizes the difficulty of maintaining that first-person pronoun as a singular through life. Because let us come to actual conversation based upon our explicit autobiographical knowledge and our implicit autobiographical memory, and we will discover that indeed we are, well, not quite so sure of being all the same all the time. Sometimes we are ill. a young lawyer whom I have known well since law school, became very ill recently. And the communications that we exchanged were communications which would have been understood primarily in terms of mental health, including during the period in which this young lawyer was hospitalized. And sometimes we are completely well. As, for example, when we are in the second semester of law school in isolation during the middle of an epidemic, sort of. And most of the time, we are sort of holding it together, as Frank Putnam's fond of pointing out. Holding it together, which I wish to congratulate you for doing so well during the second semester of law school, and which, of course, we are always doing all the time in our marriages, in our families, in our careers, in our confrontations with the conflicting nature of our lives and the inconsistent relationship between our beliefs about ourselves and our observed and quickly forgotten behavior and ideation. Holding it together is a full-time job. But when we are looking at other people, it helps for us to be looking at them as they are, not only as they are holding themselves together to present. The relationship between our understanding at the edge of social psychology and sociology, which Erwin Goffman is offering and which Art Leff is reusing, remixing, rearranging, and reanimating, at least for me, and the place where we are once we begin looking at people as collections of identity and personality states, is not very far, intellectually or perhaps even viscerally. On the one hand, we can have a dramaturgical theory of society. We can understand people's activities in the ways in which they script and follow script and cast and outcast and alter cast one another in order to achieve purposes of which they are partly consciously aware. And we can observe of the Janices we meet, the tra-la-la persona, and the hurt-not-working persona, and the hurt-working persona, and we can learn, as Marty Horowitz would have us learn if we were therapists, but we're only lawyers, how over the course of our acquaintance with people to begin to attach interpretive understandings to the personality states we see reflected in their talk and in their nonverbal communication, in their posture, in the things they fiddle with, in the way they use the chairs, and all the other things that we have, which are not therapy sessions, they're just transactions, litigations, counseling, meetings with government officials, meetings with potential clients, and etc. We have purposes, as therapists do, but our purposes are both more immediate and not necessarily entirely altruistic, or at least the altruism is our own with respect to our clients rather than that for the people we are seeing in a place where Horowitz might have seen a patient. Even clients aren't patients, after all. I notice that the predatory forms of personality condition with respect to clients are both that which the ethical regulation of the law bears down on to control and to restrain, and on the other hand, that which the ethical regulation of the law assumes requires restraint because of inherent tension between the interest of the lawyer and the interest of the client, which, even when you have finished talking about the absoluteness of the responsibility in one direction, never ceases to be bidirectional. Whether I am watching representatives of corporate clients run up the bill, or I am watching the lawyers working on behalf of persons in the immigration system turning up 5 hours late because their calendar is full, I'm aware, as you are, as we are, because we know the way we are, that it won't do merely to think in terms of what people are bound to do or say they're going to do or do most of the time. We have to understand their multiplicity in order to arrive at working understanding. My late mother, who died in the fall of 2018 at the age of 82 and some, was a feminist literary theorist and professor of literature, the first woman dean of any faculty in the entire history of the University of California, a distinction she achieved in 1978. For those of you who believe that there is some basic agreement upon the equality of women in society, you must at least understand that if there is such an agreement, it arose an instant ago, and that's why those of us who care about it doubt its completeness. My mother, who was a Freudian and a feminist struggling with Freudianism, and whose life we may have other occasion to talk about with respect to other things. My mother, it turned out after her death, my brother Seth was going through her papers and found a letter she had written to me in 1970 when I was 11 years old. Actually, she never wrote letters to me. What Seth understood to be a draft letter was in fact preparation for a speech. My mother was given to thinking carefully about what to say to me. It was what she considered a respect she was paying me, and she thought deeply and wrote it out, because she was a person who so deeply believed, as she transmitted to her son, that writing is a mode of cognition, and if you want to know something, you should write about it. She wrote things down in concerted form, and then later she talked to me on off her notes, which she didn't need to bring. And so what my brother Seth found in her papers after her death was not really a letter to me in 1970, but a preparation for a talk to be given to me in 1970 when I was 11. I don't remember the talk. I hadn't yet begun to train myself to remember everything that was said to me. That only came almost a decade later. But I was evidently having a period of anxiety. I was afraid of failing, a feeling I'm sure you can't possibly sympathize with in any way at all as you are listening to me. I was afraid of failing in life, and I was evidently concerned because a friend of our family's, whom I much admired for his wit and thoughtfulness, was not a success in life, and perhaps that was functioning as a projection screen for a number of other concerns I had about failure in life. And in trying to counsel me about my concern with failure, my mother said many different things, not all of which we need to be concerned with right now, but on the witness of the document, she began one paragraph that she wrote for ingestion by me, orally given. The topic sentence of the paragraph was, "You must always remember the multiplicity of personality." My brother was, my younger brother, he is 5 years younger than I am, and he had a different family and a different life, of course, as we all do. And he found this an enormous demonstration of the pressure that my parents and my mother, among my parents, put me under by virtue of their effort to maximize my sense of my own intelligence and its importance in the world. About which my brother Seth is right, that I experienced certain pressures growing up. And he was mostly given to a form of outrage with my mother. How could she talk to an 11-year-old this way? And I found that also a very important indication of the different families in which we grew up, because I felt that Seth didn't really understand that this was the way that Helene talked to me from the time that I was 2. But I did also think to myself, by God, at 11 she told me we must always remember the multiplicity of personality, and if I had listened to her carefully, it would have served me well, because I was in my 40s before I really got it, and I could have skipped a lot of trouble in between. We must always remember the multiplicity of personality. So we must always remember the multiplicity of personality. They're right about that, Putnam and my mother. And it's difficult for us internally. We don't necessarily want to see ourselves that way because we're busy holding it together all the time. But even if we couldn't see ourselves that way at all, which would be a shame, because it is the key to how we change. But even if we couldn't see it all, the multiplicity of personality, we could learn to see it in other people. And maybe that would help us to understand it in ourselves. And maybe we're just too busy holding it together. But it isn't merely whether one would like to be an adept parent of infants. And it isn't only whether really life with toddlers is very much assisted by an understanding that toddlers have multiplicity of personality, which is part of why they behave in the sometimes quite disappointing way in which they behave. But really, it's not only a developmental matter, it actually does affect what it means to have a conversation with a bailiff or a parole officer. Or, if you're me, with a law student. Because, after all, everything is made of people, and people are the way we are, and the more we can begin by skipping the illusions about the way we are, and the more we can perceive the facts of the way we are, the way we perceive the facts of how the law is and what it does, and therefore we can both appreciate and also contextualize and disregard the way they say they are, the law and people, not in order to make either the law or the people less comprehensible, but in order to make the complexity of how they really are more part of how we navigate in the world, the better we will do. So perhaps we are resistant. Maybe it is that you don't think that you care too much about the graphs and the images of left and right hemispheres, and maybe it is that you don't believe that there's this much biological psychiatry but only that much molecular psychiatry, or maybe it is that you actually think that the fact that Freud wasn't mentioned more than once in the intro to psych course that you took means it's all somehow not really there. But whatever it is, it it's harder to understand Carl Wiley or Jack or Robinson or Judge Celia Day, whom we're about to meet, or, well, any lawyer you interview with in the early interview, late interview, middle interview cycle of humiliation program, or perhaps even how you understand why it is that there's a part of you that is absolutely certain that you should take a job that another part of you is absolutely certain that you will hate. And how those different personality states relate to the people around them who aren't really around them, and who are in a funny way gaining more influence over mind by not existing. There's a class of client living in a part of the world in which I find it useful to come as little as possible. The people who make up the client businesses believe very much in human relationship, and they think that they would do more business with me if I were there more with them and doing things with them and knowing them better and building relationship. But I know that I gain more influence in a relationship in which I don't have much influence, because the things I'm asked to help with aren't very important things. I know that I gain more influence by remaining invisible. And of course, part of the way in which an understanding of the way we are works for you, because you're a lawyer, is to provide power. If the question is whether you should go into therapy to become a more secure and capable manipulator of other people's feelings and ideas, the answer would be no. I mean, it would be good to go into therapy and talk about your need to do that, which at some point in the future you may be doing. But this is law school. And unlike going into therapy in order to figure out how to be a more capable and secure manipulator of other people's feelings and ideas, being, well, material, it's just material. It determines outcomes, and you're supposed to be getting better at it. Now, how you're going to be getting better at it by being taught what you are being taught in property or constitutional law, I have no idea. And probably if we asked your teachers in those subjects, they wouldn't think that that's what they're doing either. But somebody should be doing it. And the somebody who should be doing it as usual is you, and the way you should be doing it is by learning things, because this is school. And here I am offering you things to learn which are helpful in this regard. You must always remember the multiplicity of personality. You may not need an agreed-upon coding system, though if you wanted it to be science, you would need that, the same way that if you wanted to believe that law was a science, you would need a code, which is part of why it is that whether that code is civil in Germany or model penal in the United States, the realist in me, and maybe even the realist in you, has ultimately begun to discover that that's bullshit. Certainly with respect to the idea that constitutional law is a code, it isn't. It's con law. And, well, you see, of course, that we don't need an agreed-upon coding system, though there is one. We're lawyers. It's always agreed upon. It always exists. It's always not any good. What we actually need is a personal coding system that works for us. This is the absolute genius of the point made by Edward Kennedy Ellington, known to the universe as Duke, that there's only two kinds of music, good music and bad music. This is directly related to the statement by the same genius, who said, I did not compose music ever. I just wrote down what people were whistling in the street. But you see, in order to have done it that way, you needed to have Duke Ellington's ears, which found the good music that people were whistling in the street and left the bad music echoing off the cobblestones. The personal coding system, the understanding of the multiplicity of personality that you adopt, is not the outcome of the science. But as you can see, the outcome of the science is a progression of dogmas and a collection of experiments that hurt people along the way. Hopefully as few as possible, for as much that can be gathered, which is why you read the dedication that Putnam left behind him on the work that ushered him out of life, and you thought, yes, that's what the dedication ought to be. Or maybe you didn't look, which is a shame, because the dedication of a book is where the dominant personality state of the author signs its name. And it's always good to look there, because the part of the author that dedicated the book is a part of the author you need to consider at every juncture along the way. It's not the only one, but it's one. And it will have been the outcome of a deeply important, possibly truncated conversation among parts. When you read the acknowledgments, you will find the same, except that acknowledgments are usually written by layers of personality states, one after the other, paragraph by paragraph. But there's no end of things that you can think about, whether they are Putnam's occasional comments on his relations to the legal system, or all the things that, if you pursued in the second half of the book, what The Way We Are has to say about addiction and abuse, trauma and its infliction, attachment problems and their social consequences, or whether you wanted to think about the second half of the second semester of law school, there's much to gain in every direction from beginning in the smallest of ways, bit by bit, detail by detail, character by character, insight by flagrantly unsupported insight, the beginning of the process of understanding that the way we are is collections of identity and personality states cycling in relatively predictable but highly complex ways that are signaled in behavioral and postural and linguistic and tonal ways that you can track and see and understand. It's a matter of learning to see and hear and to understanding what it means that we are always watching people as we work. But we can talk about this more later on. In fact, we have to. In fact, in order to have a lawyer's theory of social action and become a lot more creative in law school and to think more creatively and effectively in our careers, we're going to have to talk about this from time to time, even if there's nobody to talk about it with except ourselves. But instead of doing that, let's think a little bit about what's happening in the second half of the second term of law school. This is the time at which anxiety about performance begins to reach an unsustainable maximum. Whether people have, in fact, firmly taken aboard the fact that first semester grades don't indicate anything about long-term performance in law school, they're a temporally bound measurement of a temporal process, which, in Putnam-like terms, we can understand as the creation of an identity state that speaks law talk. Not yet a personality state, but an identity state that understands itself in terms of conversational ability in law talk. There is something else happening in the second term. The form in which this is presented is better understood in anthropological than in intrapsychic terms. It's an initiation ritual. The one that they call the bar exam, which occurs after law school, is more formalized and is differently tense and is preceded by a different set of rituals. But this one now, of course, there's a question. Is it possible to grow up in a society without attending its initiation rituals? And the answer is yes and no. But that's not the real question right now for you and me. You are about to attend the initiation rituals. Coming back from spring break has always meant, and even still means to you, perhaps worse and more intensively, the getting ready for exams business. Possibly you have heard me say, in a personality state different from the one in which you're listening to me now, that all this stuff doesn't matter. That all this initiation ritual hoo-ha, like the bar exam, about which the same will be true, is actually, well, it's like a lot of things that happen in initiation rituals. It is designed to deceive the initiate into having a hyper-intense experience. Like that moment in the initiation ritual of the Freemasons in which the initiate feels the point of the dagger against his chest and the ritual compels him to walk forward, and then as he advances, the point dissolves. For a blindfolded initiate, this is a hyper-real experience, but of course that's the purpose of the ritual, is to heighten the unreality of the initiate's reality. And so it is with the preparing for exams at the end of the first year of law school business. But, as I say, you hear me say that from time to time in a state which is different from the state in which you listen to me now, because on a basis of state-dependent learning and memory, you have cashed that reality of mine away. Either it was outvoted by all the other people who told you that the ritual is really important and the grades really matter and the exams really matter and you really have to take this seriously because this is a make-or-break moment in your life, kid. Or because in the dialogue among the parts of you, the part holding that memory of what I said and the compelling nature of its reality slipped into you and was used to bury it there by other parts going about their business, whatever their business may be. This is a time in which it would be really bad to be locked in a telephone booth and not to be able to see other people clearly. The structure of isolation. Well, maybe you remember it. I don't know which kind of undergraduate you were. Maybe you were the one who isolated in a furor of sleepless studying, and maybe you were just the one who saw it happen to other people. But you know how those contacts with other personality states work upon us, because the state that faces in state A, the state in the other in state B, that, well, you understand. This is where, from the point of view of a scientist like Frank Putnam, it becomes incalculable. And from the point of view of the data scientists of the future, this is what all that mass surveillance of you is supposed to be about, even if it's only for an ad tech platform. And for me, this is about what it means to think about the concept freedom of thought, which feels so important to me in my life, in relation to the intrapsychic identity structures of human beings who do this supposedly free thinking. And my ambition as a teacher, that you should know the difference between real bullets hitting real people who might be clients and who might be you, and imaginary, invisible bullets hitting people from ritual gunnery, aimed and fired high and constantly beating down people who feel they don't belong for whatever individual or collective reason. One way to think about the remainder of this term is that it's about all the tensions and about holding it together. And it is absolutely certain that if you think about it that way, it will be that way. The parts of you best adapted to life under those circumstances will attempt to run the place. And the parts of you that ordinarily run the place may or may not be those parts, and the result will be a good deal of internal turmoil and confusion, which can be addressed by the exchange of words with people who know you and what is going on. Which is a reason why it's bad to be in isolation. Or, this period can be not about those tensions, but rather about not having to hold it together in relation to those tensions, but having an opportunity under the condition of those tensions to add a state. A meditation state, for example, whose job it is to increase monitoring awareness of the differential behaviors of the parts of self, and to harmonize rather than exiling or beating down states which are having trouble. And which can function not as an executive for making lists and applying concentration, but as a state that understands the future, which is that you will be a lawyer for the rest of your life. You will learn to see the things that lawyers can learn to see. You will learn to have responses and to offer counsel, which is good because you understand deeply what you're looking at, including all the things that are made of people, which are all the things there are. And this is the beginning, and you're not very good at it yet. And so commandeering 3 blue books and putting in them stuff that will make the reader of the blue book say, hey, this person has a point of view. This person understands what's going on. This person has contextualized what I taught and has turned it into something in which this person is the belonger. To do that, which is not a really tough job, just commandeering a couple of blue books, you can do. Yeah, but in order to do that, it would have to feel not like tension, but like the release of tension. Not like being on the edge of being broken, but being over the edge of being whole. It would be about counterpoint. Not the rhythm being suggested by the ritual, but the other rhythm. Whether it's Thelonious Monk or it's Miles Davis, two very different, unique collection of molecules in the universe, they both know the same thing. Play what isn't there. And so do you. Some of you. I mean, some of each of you know it's there. I mean. Because, after all, even though it may be that in the beginning you want to find out why Putnam is wrong, in the end, there is a view of life that we call Darwin. And there is a view of mind that we call Freud. And somewhere past both of them, when you have learned to take aboard these ideas, not for whether they're right or wrong, but for where they lead, not only in their sciences, but in their arts, in their humanities, then you know that for the lawyer you are becoming, I mean, the lawyer who will be a new identity and personality state set that will be so different and yet so much a part of you that I have always felt as a grown-up that I could remember better what it meant to be the Eben who did not know yet how to read than I could remember what it meant to be the Eben who knew how to read but didn't yet know how to read law. Because it changed my identity and personality state so deeply and in such far-reaching ways that though they are unquestionably me, to me, and although my memory is good for everything that was said to me until now when I am old and my memory will fail and all of it will run away again into the sand after all the years and decades that I spent collecting it up, all that hoarding gone away. Even though I remember all of that, I still don't remember what it was not to have the personality and identity states inside myself that you are about to acquire. And that acquisition doesn't happen before the exams or after the exams or during the exams. The exams are irrelevant to that. The way when you get right down to it, the day of the wedding is not really much to the marriage. And the difficult and painful experience of labor is simply not much to the real meaning and life of motherhood. Because what's happening to you is happening, and it is, God knows, real. And it would be so much easier if it weren't happening in isolation. But what it is that's happening isn't over there where they direct your gaze and your attention. It's happening inside, where you must always remember the multiplicity of personality. And where the ambition isn't to hold it together, it's to change. Talk to you soon.